But the one we're going to talk about today is a trade war, and that is the U.S.-China trade war that is taking place. China.
One of the most critical issues rankling U.S.-China relations, trade.
And the trade war continues as two economies that have been integrated for decades are already drifting apart.
2019 marks 70 years since the formation of Communist China. These past decades have seen an amazing expansion of the country's economy and its political influence. Having escaped the banking crisis of 2008, China has been viewed as a model of both rampant success and fiscal stability. But still waters run deep. Beneath the surface, a compound of factors is cooking up the perfect storm, one that is in danger of taking the rest of the world's economies with it. According to today's guest, we should be paying much more attention to China.
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 Welcome. You're listening to the State of Power podcast from the Transnational Institute. My name is Sean Macheza. For today's episode, I spoke to TNI associate, anti-globalization icon, and former Philippines Member of Parliament, Walden Bello, about China and its role in the global financial system. Our discussion is guided by Walden's latest book, Paper Dragons, China and the Next Financial Crisis. China is a complex topic that can't be dealt with in half an hour, but we managed to have quite a wide-ranging discussion about, amongst other topics, the contradictions in China's financial system, the ongoing trade war with the United States, and China's overall impact on the global economy. I began by asking Walden to tell me a little bit about the book's content.
What the book highlights is, you know, that you have a very volatile financial system in China that interacting with the bigger economic problems of China, including the trade war with the United States, the tremendous overcapacity of China industrially at this point, the lack of profitability of industrial investments, all of this make China a key candidate for being a trigger for another financial crisis. Now, mind you, I'm not predicting that China will be the trigger. There are many other places that could be triggers.
Yeah.
You know, the Frankfurt, London, New York. But I'm just saying, you know, that China is a new element of instability within the global financial system, where the conditions are there for a crisis.
So what we're seeing, if I get you correctly, if we look at the conditions in the U.S. just prior to the economic crisis, mm-hmm. if we look at China mm-hmm. in the present day, we are somewhat close mm-hmm. to the same conditions just before the crisis.
Sure.
And hence, the possibility of a boiling over.
Sure. Yes, definitely. Of course, you know, there are no two crises are the same.
Yeah.
But you have certain similarities
yeah.
that should make us worry. The same sort of real estate bubble, you
yeah.
know, and the, you know, roller coaster kind of stock market,
yeah.
and then the rise of shadow banking entities that are unregulated.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, these are some of the same institutions or players
yeah.
that triggered the 2008 crisis.
Yeah.
And I'm saying that, hey,
these are some red lights.
There's some red lights that the world should be worried about here.
Yeah.
These red lights are particularly important at this point because the so-called reform of the global financial system, which the Group of 20 said would happen during the Group of 20 summit meeting in Pittsburgh, has not happened at all. For all intents and purposes, we have a very unregulated global financial system at this point. And I think nobody would claim that global finance has any real controls on it at this point.
It has not been reined in at all.
It has not yeah. been reined in. And the reason for that is that finance capital is just too strong for the governments to rein in at this point.
Explain to me first, for someone who's not familiar with this level of economics, how did China fare in the last financial crisis? And did this have any influence on the current state of affairs?
In the last financial crisis, China's financial system was still more or less protected, you know, from the global financial system. It was not that exposed to, you know, this toxic securities, yeah, you know, that were floating around in Europe and the United States. It had reasonable financial controls, okay? Yeah. And its internal finance dynamics were really under control, mm-hmm, okay? That is not the case at this point in time. Basically, you have a very heated financial sector, you know, that could run out of control anytime. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the Japanese scholar, you know, that is the top expert on Chinese finance, Professor Yoshino, says that China has, at this point in time, a bubble economy, especially when it comes to land prices. Tremendous rise of land prices in the main areas of China. You know, we have spectacular rises because of speculation. Mm. And as we all know, what goes up,
it must come down.
Must come down.
At some point.
And the question is, when will it come down? Uh-huh. But we can be sure that when prices have gone so high, and then people panic that they've gone so high, the crash, when it comes, will be very great. And it will have a chain reaction. Now, some people, of course, say, but hey, we don't have that much foreign capital that is invested in China's financial system.
You say in 2008, China was virtually insulated,
sure,
from the impacts of the,
sure,
crisis.
Sure.
So what happened to the insulation? Isn't it likely that then if there is a bubble forming in China, mm-hmm, that it will again affect China and the same wall of insulation will... what implications would this have for the world?
Yeah. Now, people say that, well, you know, China isn't that much exposed to foreign capital in its financial system, you know? Mm-hmm. China's dynamics are mainly internal. The problem is that China is a big economic player in the world. Mm-hmm. And if its financial system crashes, that has an impact on the real economy. And China is one of the, you know,
probably is now the biggest trading nation
in terms of its trade. It's up there with Germany.
Yeah.
So what happens is that every financial crisis brings down the real economy.
Yeah.
This would happen in China too. Mm-hmm. So what happened is that China's imports are going to come down.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
its exports will come down, and that will have a chain reaction with all the countries that were trading with China.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is one interesting similarity with 2008, because while China's financial system was not that exposed, mm-hmm, nevertheless, when the United States crashed and Europe crashed, it had an impact on the real economy of China. Exports, yeah, to the United States and Europe fell down. So you had something like at the level of 20 million workers that were affected in China.
So it may not be direct influence,
sure,
on the finance
side,
industry, but on the real economy it was,
that's
felt
it,
because
of course,
I mean, China's exporting to Europe.
Yes,
Europe,
right,
is not buying anymore.
Yeah.
The US is not buying anymore. People don't have money.
Yes.
And that affects China indirectly. So I can see how that...
Yes, and that could affect... If China is the center this time,
yeah,
of a financial crisis, you may not have that much exposure of foreign capital in the Chinese financial system, but the rest of the world would be affected because trade is going to fall. And
yeah,
China has become such a center,
yeah,
of trade that it would have a chain reaction everywhere. And I think that is the real danger that is posed, not so much the financial connections, but the real economy connections that would,
yeah,
be impacted on by a Chinese financial crash. Again, What I'm trying to say here is I'm not making a prediction. You know, you have different points of vulnerability. I'm just saying that the conditions whereby China could be a trigger are being created at this point in time. And that's why we really need to look at the Chinese situation very closely.
So if we look at the Chinese economy is in a sort of different way, too big to fail, in the sense that if the Chinese engine was to stop turning right now, it would have a huge implication for the global economy.
Yeah, it would have a very big implication for the global economy. Yeah. And now, you know, not only do you have this financial volatility in China, you have the trade war within the United States, which is creating a lot of lack of confidence in the Chinese economy. You have a crisis of overproduction in China that, you know, levels of profitability is down. And even if in the trade war, you cannot say that if exports go down, hey, we can move to the domestic economy. No, domestic production of industrial goods is no longer profitable. So basically, is where will the investment go in China if the trade war intensifies? It's going to go into finance, to real estate, creating an even bigger problem.
Let's unpack that a little more, because you hear about the trade war and you hear about the influence that the current administration in the U.S., that their policies are having on China. Could you break it down? And I know it's a very complex topic, but then just like, this is what's happening with the trade war, and this is its current impact on China's economy and on China's finance system and how it links with the content of the book.
Well, you know, I basically, I think what's happening is that Trump has imposed big tariff raises on Chinese products coming into the United States. It has already brought down Chinese exports to the United States because they're getting expensive with all the, you know, the tariffs, you know, being imposed on Chinese goods at this point in time. So there is already a crisis of overproduction in China, which makes it very unprofitable to produce many of the same things that are being produced for export. If you're a Chinese investor, whether you're state enterprise or you're private Chinese investors, you want to make money, there will be a great tendency for you to, oh my God, the only place where I can make money at this point is no longer in exporting to the United States or to Europe, but basically the internal market.
To avoid paying the tariffs that have been put on Chinese goods.
Yeah, but then the internal market is no longer profitable. So where will they go? They'll go into speculation, in real estate, in the stock market.
The internal market is not working because it's saturated?
It's saturated.
Chinese... spending power is reached its limit.
Yeah, well, two things there. There is, on the one hand, there's great inequality in China. Okay, so that purchasing power is, you know, it's a very unequal society at this point. Like, you cannot rely on domestic purchasing power to be able to sustain demand. But aside from that, there's also overcapacity of industry. Because what's happened is that there's been so much investment in all sorts of heavy industry, middle-level industry, etc., that, you know, if you can no longer produce for export, you already were
overproduction. Locally.
And so it will create an even greater crisis of overproduction.
It's fascinating how something that's touted as a good thing in many economies, like develop, build more factories, how it turns out to be now a negative for China.
It's come to the point where China is looking to export its overproduction outside. And this is the reason why you have what is called the Belt and Road Initiative, because they want to employ all of those industries in infrastructure building in Central Asia, in South Asia, in Southeast Asia, because they have all this capacity.
There's no more capacity to absorb all of this locally.
And that matters because if you don't put that capacity into operation, you don't make profits.
Uh-huh.
Okay, the Chinese economy, which was touted to be such a strong economy, a roaring tiger, a big dragon, actually it's saturated with major contradictions mm-hmm. that could unravel it at this point in time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some people say, oh, the Chinese economy hasn't had any major problem for so many years. They will go through this. Yeah, but this is a very different time.
Yeah.
And this is a time where the United States is determined to cut down China. And that's mm-hmm. the new thing.
This external factor
yes,
of the United States actively working against China.
Destabilizing China. Yeah, this was not there before. Before you had a sort of a partnership between the United States and China, economically in the sense that, hey, you had all those corporations move to China to exploit cheap labor. And although there were conflicts in trade policy over whether China was manipulating its currency, nevertheless, you had this kind of partnership between U.S. transnationals and China.
Uh-huh.
But now that's different. Right now you have a Trump administration that basically says, hey, China, you know, you've been screwing us up.
Uh-huh.
You know, you've been exporting these cheap goods to us. You put our workers out of business. We're no longer going to accept those goods, even if they're being produced by our corporations.
Uh-huh.
So this is really the new factor at this point in time. And I think this has shown the weaknesses of the Chinese economy
mm-hmm.
that interacting with the financial speculative volatility in China could create a major problem not only for the United and not only for China but for the rest of the world as well.
You're listening to the State of Power podcast from the Transnational Institute. TNI is an international research and advocacy institute committed to building a just, democratic, and sustainable planet. This podcast is just one way in which we share the ideas and thoughts of the activists and scholars in our network. The episode you're listening to features a conversation with Weldon Bellow on China and its possible role in the next global financial crisis. On our website, you can find earlier episodes of the podcast and some of our latest work. For example, our analysis of the border industrial complex in the United States and a report on multi-stakeholderism. Our website is www.tni.org. And now, back to Weldon Bellow and the contradictions that exist in China's financial system.
You mentioned that there's a lot of contradictions in the Chinese economy. And the impression I get is that some of those contradictions are actually being met or mitigated by this shadow banking system.
Mm-hmm.
How does it work?
Well, the shadow banking system in China has emerged because so much of the financing from the Chinese banks are going mainly to the big state enterprises that are serving the export sector.
The banks themselves are state-owned?
Or? Yes, it's state-owned.
So it's state-owned banks.
So it's state-owned banks financing state enterprises, as well as big private enterprises that are mainly concentrated on what we would call the export industrial sector of the economy. So you have basically so much of the savings of Chinese people being channeled towards this preferred customers, okay? So this has several effects. Small Chinese and medium industries, you know, are lacking in terms of where are they going to get money in terms of starting up or maintaining their enterprises. So what happens is this shadow banks, okay, which are not regulated, emerge to fill this need, okay?
Uh-huh.
And, you know, they would offer all sorts of really nice goodies to these enterprises.
Mm-hmm.
And they themselves, however, through various means, obtain their money from various sources, including from the big state banks themselves. So what you now have is a situation whereby you now have a really big shadow banking system that has emerged to fulfill the needs of small and medium industries.
Mm-hmm. Because all the money is being channeled to
these big ones, focused on exports.
Yeah.
Now, the other thing, there's such a lack of investment opportunities in China, meaning, you know, that depositing your money in the Chinese banks, the interest rates are so small.
So there's no point in
So, you know, so a lot of people basically would say, hey, if they have some extra cash, they would much rather put that into the real estate speculation or the stock market.
The stock market. Play around
and
with numbers
play around with
and
that.
Finance
and,
system.
You know, so not only if they have some money, but, you know, if they begin to really become serious players, they also go to the shadow bankers, you know, in order to be able to get money for this.
Get more money.
Now, the problem here is that they have to have some collateral. Uh-huh. And the collateral is land. Okay, uh-huh. So basically you have all these people, you know, borrowing on the strength of their land, okay? Mm-hmm. And therefore, the shadow banks lend to property developers, mm-hmm. Lend to residential speculators.
Yeah.
And if that all crashes, then everybody
crashes,
including the shadow banks. Now, since the shadow banks themselves have borrowed a lot of money from the formal
banks.
Banking sector, you know, sometimes through illegal means because there's a lot of corruption, that will also have a major negative impact on the formal banking system. So that's sort of the chain reaction you would expect from a speculative bust in China at this point in time. You have all the key players interconnected.
And so the shadow banks are operating also in a space where they're not accounted for in measuring the Chinese economy. And what's not measured cannot be managed, right?
Yes, and so the authorities have allowed that to happen because...
That's what I was about to ask. How I thought China was such a...
No.
A regimented...
No, it's not.
This
is one of the most... it's one of the most decentralized countries in the world.
Well, yeah.
Economically, where local authorities... working with local enterprises have a great degree of distance from the center. It is an economic system that has an outer facade of centralization, but is actually quite decentralized with a lot of local authorities playing very strong independent roles. In fact, the central authorities basically have tolerated that because this private enterprises and small enterprises need some access to credit.
Yeah.
And they've been complaining. So they've sort of tolerated it to let out steam.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and so they have allowed it to grow and grow and grow. Now they begin
now
to realize
such a big,
big thing that
economy.
It creates a tremendous threat to the system. And so they're now trying to bring them under control. But I think it's very difficult to bring them under control because... First of all, a lot of them are connected to local authorities that have a lot of independence from the center.
Yeah. Yeah.
So this is one of the problems, in fact, that China faces at this point.
Yeah.
There's an extreme decentralization of economic authority, which means that the capacity of the center to be able to regulate things,
rein in things,
is quite weak.
So there's indeed like a lot of leaks that the center can control.
Definitely. And this is in fact one of the points that we brought out in the book, that one of the strengths of the Chinese economy in the past was its decentralized character.
Yeah.
There's been great competition at the local level, but now we are at a stage where that is
creating an advantage.
Yes,
really.
An advantage.
Still,
the whole thing
China.
Is kept together by the Communist Party system.
Yeah.
But, you know, and this is the reason that China doesn't fall apart, because you do have government.
Is that cohesion at the
you know,
the
there's
level.
There's the government level, but there's also the party that controls the government. It's economically decentralized, but political authority is concentrated at the Communist Party level. So China doesn't fly apart despite the decentralization because of the discipline of the Communist Party, where the conflicts are worked out. But again, these are conflicts that there are some winners and there are some losers.
Can we just zoom out a little bit now from China? What are the neoliberal elements that we see expressing themselves in China? Is this part of the main reasons behind this current...
Well, what we're in now really is we're in an era which has been characterized by one financial crisis after another. And a lot of this has been because of neoliberal practices, and particularly neoliberal practices in the financial sector. And it comes down basically to one thing, which is deregulate as much as possible, as much freedom to market forces and to corporate forces, get government out of regulating finance, get government away from regulating the economy, push market.
No and, regulation, let equilibrium come naturally.
And basically, in 2008, that model crashed. And that model crashed because of a lack of regulation of the shadow banking system in the U.S. Now, in 2009, there was the Pittsburgh Summit, which basically said, oh, we're going to have now a strong regulation of the banking system. That has not happened. Okay, the banks have become even more concentrated, like in the United States. The banks have become even too big,
even bigger than they were.
Than they were. The same sort of toxic securities like mortgage-backed securities are still being traded around in trillions. Derivatives, again, you know, this toxic financial engineered products that help cause the crisis are still being actively traded with very little controls. And the executive pay of financial operators remains extremely high. And this whole structure, instead of being regulated, has been sustained mainly because the central banks has been buying up the debts of the private banks so that they will have money to to spend. And the theory was that the banks being given this free money by the central banks of the United States, the European Central Bank, you know, would help restart the economy. They've not done that. And, you know, they've kept all that money to themselves.
The money still goes, it doesn't go back into the...
They've held on to it. So basically, this is the fragility of this system at this point. Neoliberalism continues to be dominant. State regulation of finance has not occurred. And new vulnerabilities, like the emergence of China as a vulnerability, has emerged. So you now have a system, a global financial system, that continues to be unregulated, which has new vulnerabilities at this point in time, and which continues to operate according to the doctrine of neoliberalism, which is more market, less state, more deregulation, less regulation. So basically, this is a discredited doctrine, but it's just like...
For some reason, it continues to be the way things are done.
The way that I would put it, like in the old cowboy movies, the outlaws raid the train, and they've shot the engineer of the train. He's dead, but his hand
still on
is on the lever, on the accelerator. And he's dead, but it's there. That's how neoliberal doctrine is. It's the dead hand of the operator on the accelerator of the train. And the train continues to speed up as a result. So this is, you know, what, you know, so, you know, the train is coming near the bend, you know. And it's speeding up instead of slowing down. you can almost see what's going to happen.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So
we see the next crisis.
Right.
Indeed.
2009 was a big warning. It was the last big warning. There were several warnings before that. But nothing has happened.
Yeah.
So that's taking place in a situation where at the same time you have growing geopolitical competition.
Mm-hmm.
And where the United States and China are now confronting each other in a situation where there is no longer a line between economic warfare and military warfare.
It's all blurred up.
Yeah. You see, Trump's people,
yeah.
you know, they...
The trade war is just part of another...
Yeah, it's like a continuum spectrum, between, yeah. between military and economic. And there's that zone which is blurred.
Yeah.
And the Trump people basically, you know, think, you know, that China... has taken advantage of the United States and that it's now payback time. So you have economic nationalism, you have this kind of let's bring China to heel. Mm-hmm. At the same time, you still have neoliberal arrangements in finance. So it's all coming together in this very, very dangerous way.
Mm-hmm. How would you respond to criticisms from Will Hutton, for instance, who says, well, it's not neoliberalism that's to blame. There's other factors outside of it. What would you say to that?
Well, his argument when he reviewed the book was a bit confused, I mm-hmm. would say, because he says, of course, it's neoliberalism out there, but when it comes to China, it's something else. And what he was basically saying was I had framed the discussion on China as a fight between those who wanted to liberalize the financial sector mm-hmm. and socialists who wanted to keep the old state-run economy functioning. And that was not the way that I had framed the discussion. I had framed the discussion as between those who wanted to liberalize the economy and the financial economy, for instance,
yeah.
and the export-oriented lobby that wanted to monopolize the benefits of finance from that economy. And those were not socialists.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
those
yeah.
they were two factions of the same ruling elite.
Yeah.
And
none of them more socialist than the other. Really,
no. In fact, they were, you know, they were, you know,
competing interests.
They were competing interests, and the people were not benefiting from this competition. It was mainly the interests of these two factions that were clashing, and the export-oriented lobby in China has been dominant so far, and finance continues to be very strictly controlled for the benefit of the export-oriented lobby. So that was the argument that I was making. But Will Hutton made, I don't know whether he hadn't read the book, but he basically said that I was framing the discussion between real socialists and neoliberals. And only a fool would make that kind of a framework. So I wish that he had read the book, because he even said that, why didn't I consult certain books on the global financial crisis? And he mentioned a number of people that I, in fact, cited extensively in the book. So the problem was that he didn't read the book or did not read it carefully
mm-hmm.
and made all sorts of assumptions. We have to understand the complexity of global finance.
Yeah.
We have to understand the complexity of the Chinese economic system. And that's what I've been trying to break down in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And I think some people don't like complexity. And we just want to simplify it. Unfortunately, the way they simplify it is a distortion of the arguments being presented. So, I mean, I really hope he does read the book.
You're listening to the State of Power podcast in conversation today with Walden Bellow. To round up our conversation, I asked Walden to place his book in a slightly wider context.
The book is not just about finance.
Yeah.
It focuses on finance, but it draws out the implication for the rest of the economy, as well as for climate change and a number of other things.
Mm-hmm.
There's a whole section on a program of reforms that needs to be done that includes 100% reserve banking. Mm-hmm. That means a new Bretton Woods conference. Mm-hmm. That means...
So no more voodoo economics and numbers.
Right? Okay. And then where we must put finance in the whole system. Mm-hmm. Because right now, the world is suffering from stagnation and overcapacity and overproduction. Mm-hmm. And that unless we understand that that's the real economy problem, in which the solution of capitalism is to go into speculative finance to draw profits, because you can no longer draw profits from the...
There's a limit to what you can get from the
productive
real economy.
Yeah. Then unless we bring that in, you know, we won't really understand the full implications of the lack of financial regulation at this point in time. Yeah. And then we really need to look at how resolving the financial issue cannot be disconnected from resolving how do we deal with capitalism. And we need to go beyond capitalism in order to have a real financial system in which we link the people who have resources to the people who need those resources. And not only the people who need those resources to invest, but the institutions that need those resources to be able to create a world that is safe from climate change.
TNI is an international research and advocacy institute committed to building a just, democratic, and sustainable planet. For more than four decades, we've supported the major social movements of the day, providing them with research, ideas, as well as logistical support. We're based in Amsterdam, and we believe there are alternatives to the world as it currently exists. We hope you believe this too. Thank you so much for listening this far. TNI's material is all free, but we would greatly appreciate your help to keep doing the work we do. If you'd like to find out more about TNI's work, please look us up at www.tni.org and find us on social media at TN Institute on Twitter and Transnational Institute on Instagram and Facebook.